Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. Hannah Natenson was on the Harvard's women varsity soccer team back in 2016 when the story broke that the Harvard's men's soccer team had a tradition of producing sexually explicit scouting reports, ranking players on the women's team by things like their appearance and ideal sexual position. The 9-page document that was discovered in 2016 included photos and disparaging remarks about each player, most of which are too explicit to read on air. The men's team did apologize for the reports, and after Harvard canceled the rest of the men's team's season, everyone seemingly moved on. But for Natenson, who's now a senior and the managing editor of the Harvard Crimson, those words stuck with her in ways she didn't fully understand until much later. The story hit like a slap, but the afterburn lasted for days, she writes, in a piece for the Crimson entitled The Way Things Linger. Hannah would later quit the team before her junior season, though at the time she said she wasn't able to admit to herself that the scouting report had been a factor in that decision. We spoke with Hannah Natenson yesterday about her experiences, starting with what it was that she loved about soccer, a sport she had played since she was 5 years old.
I think at first I just really liked the running. I would just run around the field, often not in the same direction as the ball, apparently. but then after that, it sort of I kept doing it, and then I got the sense that I could be competitive at it, and then I sort of fell in love with being on a team and being a key part of a team and just being like an integral person on the field working towards something that was bigger than any one person on that field. And so I just sort of fell in love with it and then realized I could, if I worked at it, probably rise to play in college, and then realized I could do D1, and things sort of kept continuing from there.
So we'll step back now to October 2016. It came out that the 2012 men's soccer team at Harvard had produced these sexually explicit scouting reports, rating, ranking members of the women's team. Can you talk a little bit about how you found out that these reports were happening?
Yeah, I just remember the coach did approach us a couple days before and say the Crimson has a story on the men's team and it's bad. I don't know what it is. That was kind of the only advance warning I had of it in any way, that anyone did on the team. And then I don't really remember any exact moment, but I do remember repeatedly refreshing it on my phone when I thought I was by myself. So just before bed, you know, in the bathroom, because we didn't really want to talk about it amongst ourselves. We were competing for an Ivy League championship, which we did later win. But we didn't really discuss it, and I didn't really talk about it with anyone on the team or otherwise.
Can you talk a little bit about how it made you feel about yourself? And you talk in the piece a lot about kind of the lasting effects in terms of how you see yourself and your body.
It wasn't like an immediate effect. It was this lingering thing that slowly seemed to gain more and more significance or prominence in my life. And the way that it manifested was that in the very moments that I used to find the most self-possession, self-confidence, which is when I was exercising, which I love, I started to sort of constantly feel that I was being watched or judged, or imagine that I was being watched or judged, or just be thinking about how my exercise clothes fit, or like how maybe my body wasn't in the perfect condition that I wanted it to be. And it just slowly, the joy that I used to find in daily exercise sort of leached out. And it's taken me a while to admit that, to see that, and then to start working through that, which I finally have done. But I think part of why I wanted to write this is because I just wanted to show that it's like I said, things linger, consequences linger. It's not a one and done, maybe I have a kumbaya moment and now I've moved on. It's like it sticks with you.
Yeah. At the time you wrote that you guys, the women's team, had conversations about kind of what would happen to the men's team and if this would affect them down the road professionally. Was that something you were really genuinely concerned about, or did that come from kind of chatter you heard on campus? I'm just curious kind of the mindset of those concerns.
I don't remember much beyond being just really curious to know if being tied to a program, particularly the men who were in the senior class when this 2012 report came out, like, right, if that would have any consequences. I think I was curious as a woman and as a person.
You also mentioned at the time that you guys, the women's team, had asked the men's team not to contact you, but that they did anyway, in some cases slipping notes under your doors. I'm curious if you can kind of expand on those efforts to contact you, do you think they were genuine? Was it scrambling to kind of protect themselves, and how it felt after you had said, please don't reach out to us?
Yeah, I really don't. I don't want to, like, comment on their what they were doing or their motivations, partly because this piece is really not about them or for them.
Sure.
It's not against them either. It's for me, and it's for other women who might have gone through the same thing.
Yeah. I want to move to some more uplifting conversation. You talked earlier that you're going to be running the Boston Marathon.
Yes, I am.
You run every day now, you said.
Yes, I do.
What's it like to get that back?
It's been wonderful. I think I had this moment the other day where I was running and I did some like faster mile time, which I'm not going to reveal on the air because it's not that fast and I will be embarrassed. But it was a faster mile time than I'd done in a couple years because I was never a long distance runner. I was always a sprinter. And I've started to do longer and longer runs. I've done over 20 miles at this point. And I had this moment like a couple weeks or I don't remember months back where I suddenly realized that I felt like an athlete again. And that had been such a huge part of my identity for so long, but I had lost that. And so just feeling like I'm an athlete who can do physical feats with my body is great. Feeling like I have a goal to train towards is great. Being part of a team is great. So I'm running for the Boston Public Library. I'm part of a team of several people. They're awesome. I do have to raise money for it, but.
You wrote in the piece that running sometimes you just kind of get lost in it, and then it's kind of very therapeutic, and then sometimes you feel some of that negativity seeping back in. Is that still the case? Have you seen that happen less often?
Yeah, I think it's still, it's not, like, some runs are amazing, and some days it's like, oh, man, I don't feel great. This run isn't going great. These athletic pants feel kind of tight, like, ugh, what's going on? It's not a constant, but I would say overall, it's become a much more positive thing, and I think it is becoming more and more positive as I keep running.
That's great. I'm curious if you still kind of follow soccer globally, professionally. There's a news story just this month. Norwegian soccer player Ada Heidenberg won the Ballon d'Or. She's the first woman to ever win this award for the best soccer player in the world. They've never given it to a woman before. She went up on stage to accept the award, and the DJ who was hosting the event asked her to twerk. She just kind of dismissed it, said no, and moved on. She was asked about it afterwards by the BBC, and she actually said she wasn't offended by the incident. She was just taken off guard by it. We have a little bit of sound of that.
I'm surprised that he didn't ask a more advice question, maybe about how I felt or about the football part. But I was just happy to win the Ballon d'Or.
I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about kind of sexism in sport more generally.
I mean, unfortunately, as I think some of the responses that I got from other women, particularly who were athletes, proves as well, it's pervasive. The women in sports and their bodies and the relationship between their sport and their body is charged in a lot of ways, and I think that is tied to the way that female athletes are all too often reduced to what they look like and not who they are as an athlete. And it does happen, I'm sure, for men as well. But I think, you know, after playing 15 years of competitive sport, I can say that it happens at the level I was at. It happens, obviously, the level that this woman, this fantastic soccer player, has reached as well. And I think that's probably part of why she wasn't surprised.
Is there anything that you want people to take away from your piece, women, men?
Anyone who has gone through a similar thing, I would want them to take away that they're not alone, first of all. They're not alone in questioning their self-worth via what their body looks like at times. And also that even when you do have a moment in which you or you know, or others very close to you are reduced to their bodies or someone tries to reduce them to their bodies, it's something that it may stick with you for a long time, but it's not something that you need to accept. It's something that you can absolutely fight and do battle with. And if my personal experience with this helps validate anyone else who is going through the same thing or knows someone who's going through the same thing or a similar thing, then that article has done its job.
Yeah. Well, that's Hannah Natenson. She's a senior at Harvard, managing editor of the Harvard Crimson. Her piece is called The Way Things Linger. You can find it on our website, radioboston.org. Hannah, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more on this story and a wider look at the year's biggest stories in women's sports, we're joined by WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So we actually talked with you about this Harvard soccer story when it first broke in 2016. What's your reaction hearing Hannah's perspective?
Well, I think, you know, it's really interesting to see a couple years out and hear about how the effects of the what was then called the scouting report by the men's soccer team linger, how those effects linger. And I think it brings a really valuable perspective because it isn't just about what happens in the moment. It isn't just about what's said or what's written in the moment and then the consequences that followed. As you may remember, the men's soccer team had their season canceled after this all came out, after the Crimson article came out. That's important then, but this has a sort of a long tail, and the after effects are still being felt, obviously, by some of the women who were essentially the victims of what the men's soccer team did. So I think it's really valuable to revisit it and to hear how these things linger.
Yeah, absolutely. I know you yourself were an athlete at Harvard. You ran on the women's cross-country and track teams. Did her story resonate with you?
It did in a way, though I think I had a much different experience. I don't want to date myself too much, but I competed and attended Harvard before social media had taken off, before the internet had taken off.
Right.
And I think that's sort of a key element into this story, too, because female athletes, I think, nowadays are subject to more sexism, more direct abuse through social media channels, through the internet. I mean, you hear it with female sports journalists. You hear it with female athletes. What they get via social media is just unbelievable and unbelievably harsh. So it was a much different environment, but it definitely resonates because you don't want to think that your male counterparts are viewing you, you know, or objectifying you, or viewing you, you know, and thinking about you in terms of your looks
right.
instead of in terms of your talent.
Yeah. You heard me ask Hannah about Ada Hegerberg's unfortunate experience during her acceptance of the Ballon d'Or earlier this month. What did you think of that incident and how Hegerberg responded?
So it's really interesting because Hegerberg authored a piece in the Players' Tribune a couple of days ago. And what she did in that piece, I thought, was sort of reclaim the moment, right? She talked about when she first found out about her club team coach and how excited she was. And
called
how
her mom and dad.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
If you're the coach, was like, keep it a secret, keep it a secret. And then, of course, the first thing she does is go into her car and call her mom and dad. And, you know, her mom's crying. And her dad is just an absolute disbelief. And then she talked about that night and what it meant to her to be alongside all the great men's players in the game and to see the respect that those male players had for her and how important that was and how empowering it was in the moment. And then she sort of just has like a little line. And she goes, and none of this is going to be taken away by a dumb joke made by a presenter. And I think that's really important. And I think what she's doing and how she's reacting now, not just in the moment by saying, no, I don't twerk, but now saying, this is my moment. This is how I'm going to choose to remember it. And that is, you know, the way she's going to choose to remember it is, it was a great moment for women's football. It was a great step forward for, you know, women's soccer. And I'm already using the European terms for women's soccer. A great step forward. A real progress is being shown here. And one bad joke isn't going to take that away from me or from other women who play the game.
Yeah, that was actually a theme that Hannah echoed, that whole I wrote this piece for me, not for the men's team, not for anybody else, but for me.
Exactly.
Kind of reclaiming
and
that.
I think both of them, Hannah and Ada, are saying, like, we have the right to claim these moments as our own.
Yeah.
Other people can't interpret our narratives or claim our narratives or put our, you know, tell our narratives for us. We can do it ourselves.
So, unfortunately, sexism in sports is not a new phenomenon, but there were some pretty blatant examples this year. You do an annual look back at the year in women's sports for the Boston Globe. Were there any other sexism in sports stories that kind of jumped out at you this year?
Yeah, you know, there were a couple, you know, one small, I'll choose a couple because there were many
course,
that always jump
course,
out at me every year. But a couple, one was what happened at Rowan University. That's sort of maybe the under the radar moment. That was a group of female cross country runners, probably why I connected with it, finishing up a track workout in their sports bras. The football coaches were not happy about this, complained. And then there was sort of a whole storm that followed about whether whether the women at Rowan University could or could not practice in their sports bras. And it just, the thought that sports bras would rile up a football team, or that football coaches would think that women in sports bras training, running mile repeats on a track, was a distraction in 2018 was just mind-boggling. And the reaction that followed was sexist. And of course, I think everyone remembers this is the big moment. Serena Williams, final of the U.S. Open, and she gets into an argument with the chair umpire. I believe his name was Carlos Ramos. Yeah. And, you know, she was penalized a point, then a game. And it became this whole conversation about how women are treated. Rules are applied differently to them. There's sexism in that. She was seen as overly aggressive. Whereas, you know, when a male tennis player argues, he's not seen as overly aggressive. So it raised a lot of issues about race, about gender, about the inconsistent application of rules that often is to the disadvantage of female athletes. Yeah. So that was another incident that
That was out. A really interesting one. I think there were a lot of layers there, as you mentioned, race and gender, and the Williams sisters in general have had a ton of kind of criticism and double standards pushed upon them.
Yes.
There was also, she herself has said, I think she told Billie Jean King recently that she realizes her behavior was inappropriate. You know, she violated a rule, and the second penalty was kind of by the book. It had to happen.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean what she was talking about, the fact that these right. rules are inconsistently applied, that women are often penalized more when they become aggressive on the court, doesn't mean that that doesn't have some validity. And, you know, that should be talked about, too, that has to be rectified.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So let's look at some positive stories. How about Yay. Progress for women in sports? any moments that jumped out for you this year?
Of course. Always a bunch. I'll try to pick a few. One thing that stood out to me, again, something that might be a little bit under the radar, but there's a pro golfer, a champion pro golfer named Stacey Lewis, and she was pregnant, and her main sponsor, KPMG, picked up her contract for all of 2018, even though, because she was pregnant, she would only be able to play half the season. I think that's a big step forward to recognizing that pro female athletes need sort of financial protection when they have to take maternity leave, that they shouldn't have to choose between their career and, you know, stopping their career for a moment in time and financial security.
Right.
I think also looking at some of the broadcasting stories, we had three women who were the first all-female trio to broadcast an MLS game. That happened for a New England Revolution game in August. It's also believed that they were the first group of all-women broadcast team for one of the big five men's professional teams. And then on Thursday nights, if you like, your NFL broadcast with a heavy dose of femininity. If you like to hear women talk football, you can listen to Andrea Kramer and Hannah Storm broadcast games on Amazon.
And they are both phenomenal.
Yes.
Phenomenal.
And they don't get enough play.
Absolutely. I would agree with you there. What about closer to home? Anything catch your eye here in Boston? I know you're a runner. I have a feeling where you're going.
You know
with
where
this.
I'm going with this. Of course, Des Linden winning the Boston Marathon, you know, ending a 33-year drought. She was the first American woman to win since 1985.
Unfortunately, I do have to shift gears here a bit and ask you about one major story that kind of highlights the worst elements that women in sports are faced with. It's been a story that's been going all year and is going to continue into next year, and that's the Larry Nassar U.S. gymnastics story. Remind us where we stand on that and kind of what's next for the sport of gymnastics.
Yeah, that's a big question mark at this point, because where we stand is the USOC has moved to decertify USA Gymnastics. Meanwhile, a recent report out from investigators at the Ropes and Gray, a Boston-based law firm, have said that two USOC executives did nothing when they learned about the allegations against Larry Nassar. So the future of USA Gymnastics is uncertain. I believe they will be decertified in 2019, and then the future of the USOC is uncertain,
right.
What it's going to look like in 2019. I think at the very least there's going to be a major restructuring there, and they're going to review the governance, you know, how the USOC governs its sports, but also how the USOC is governed by Congress.
Well, I'm sure we'll have you back to talk about that. That's Shira Springer, WBUR Sports and Society reporter. Shira, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me. You can find a link to Shira's look back at the year in women's sports at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, should Baby It's Cold Outside be taken out of holiday music rotation? I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston.